Hi, I'm Mike Penrose.
And I'm Alex Smith.
And this is the Business of Sustainability podcast brought to you by Future Plus.
Today, we bring you an incredibly special episode as we launch the new Sustainable Futures Live event series, which is brought to you in partnership with Sustainable Ventures. We join you from Sustainable Ventures headquarters in London, and we have the pleasure of hearing David Abramovich, founder and CEO of Grind Coffee, with us this evening.
Thank you for having me.
And in the next half hour or so, we'll discuss with David's Grind's journey from an iconic Shoreditch cafe to a brand that's now synonymous with sustainability, the challenges he faced and the strategies he's implemented, and hopefully what the future holds, if you'll share it with us.
So David, thank you ever so much for joining us. I think probably a very good place to start is a little bit on your background. How did you get to where you are today?
Sure. Well, hi everyone. So our story began in 2011. Hopefully some of you might have visited Shoreditch Grind, which is which was our first store. It's a little circular building on the edge of Old Street Roundabout in East London. That actually used to be my dad's mobile phone shop. So he signed the lease on that in 1993. When I was eight, and that was kind of the center of the family business, which was, you know, selling mobile phones to businesses. Back in those times, it was a bit more like Beverly Hills Cop, car phones kind of stuff. That became the place where I kind of got my business education, really. Like, so I used to repair Nokia phones upstairs, and I used to, as 13, would call business customers and pretend to be a grown-up trying to sell them phones and stuff like that. So, you know, I learned how to add VAT and, you know, all the basics, like the basics of business, I learned there. Unfortunately, my dad passed away when I was 25, and I inherited the business, and there wasn't, you know, it wasn't a fantastic business by that point. He'd been ill for a little while. But I loved the building, and I never considered for a second that we would give the building back to the landlord. You know, we had a very long lease. And so it was like, okay, love this building. What are we going to do with it? And I'd kind of always thought that it would be much better as a meeting place for people. Somewhere people could get together. And what do people meet to do? Coffee. Okay, well, how can we do coffee, but do it just better in every way? So let's take the best bits of Starbucks, which are, or the other chain coffee companies, such as Costa, which is that they're efficient, they're consistent, they're fast, the credit card works, and all those kind of basics that they're actually really good at. And then let's take the best bits of the specialty coffee scene, you know, high quality product, real baristas who really care about what they're doing, really high levels of design, and make it fun and turn the music up and make it accessible. And that really kicked off the whole thing. And obviously a lot's happened since then.
There'll be a lot of entrepreneurs listening. There'll be entrepreneurs here in the audience. Lots of people have coffee shops. Lots of people open a cafe, a coffee shop. You know, but it takes an entrepreneurial spirit to turn that into a brand, a chain, something that's now in all major supermarkets. It's all over the place. What was it that made you go from taking over your dad's shop and opening a coffee shop to Grind? And Alex was saying today, one of those days she walked the posters in the tube, we saw Grind. The posters on the street, we saw Grind. We see that it all over. Walk through BrewDog today, we saw Grind. What took you from your dad's cell phone shop to Grind as it is today?
It's a good question. You just, you know, one thing led to another, and here we are. Look, I think there was no master plan. It was a series of decisions, and you reach a point and you decide the next thing you're going to do and the next thing you're going to do and the next thing you do, and you keep going. So, you know, I decided to leave the other business that I had at the time, focus on Grind full time. I knew that I would be really bored if I just had one store. So I didn't leave until I'd raised the money to do the next four. So then we're five stores, and then it's like, okay, well, we've done this now, a little bit of settling down. Let's raise the money to do the next five and the next five. And then, you know, the stores got bigger. We started opening cafes that they incorporated alcohol, and we started to become a bit more of a lifestyle brand. And then it was about, okay, well, how can we, you know, do we just want to open stores forever? Or actually, I think there's an opportunity to take the brand into other places. So we decided to launch our compostable coffee capsules. Hopefully someone in the room might have tried those before. Well, there's someone there. There's some on the chairs, if not. And that's turned out to be a bigger part of the business than the high street combined. And then it's like, you know, okay, well, where do we take it next? Let's take it to where people buy coffee, grocery. And can we partner with other brands? So, you know, let's partner with the brands that I love and help them do better coffee. So look, I guess it was, you know, a combination of my kind of desire, just to keep building, and just the fun and the challenge of keeping building. And then it's about, you know, trying to piece together investors and an amazing team to drive it all, right? Because you very quickly realize that you can't do it all yourself, and you've got to start building the team out. And then you have to hire people who also really want to build something. They don't want it to stand still.
And in that building, I mean, that's quite the journey. And I think you make it sound, I'm probably sure it's a lot harder than you've made it sound, of that sort of expansion over time. But what I think has also been core, as you said right at the beginning, is making better coffee throughout that entire process, and having that as a sort of, you know, that core piece going through. And sustainability has been part of that decision. And how natural was it for you to come to that decision, and how hard has it been to keep sustainability as part of that core offering when you're talking about it? Because expansion is hard, right? You know, the supply chains, people you're working with, new stores, there's just constantly decisions to make, and to keep sustainability in that is quite a challenge.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, I'm not sure when we became a sustainability focused company, right? There wasn't a moment. It was like at some point early on, it was like, oh God, you know what? We've got 5 stores now. So instead of buying in the white cups and someone stamping them, we can afford to like have them printed. And it's like, okay, cool. Do you want the compostable ones or the other ones? Compostable ones are twice the price, but I feel like we should get the compostable ones because people would like that. And that it's basically that again and again and again and again. So one of my favorite examples is that you know in the roastery in Bermondsey, when you make the actual bags of coffee, they have a little valve on them to allow the oxygen to escape. And the plastic ones of those are like 0.8 of a penny, and the compostable ones are 18 pence. Which is like pretty meaningful in the context of like of a £7 item. It was like, we've got to do that because, you know, we've set ourselves this challenge of being plastic free and being sustainable. So we have to do that until we can figure out a way to have no valve at all, which turned out to be, you know, better compostable material. It's just like you're constantly faced with decisions about kind of doing the right thing or not. And actually, it's not just about doing the right thing in terms of it being the right thing, but it's also what your customers expect and what your team expects. And, you know, that's how you build trust, and that's how you build long-term love for a brand and for a business, by doing the right thing. And there's so much invisible stuff as well. Like, there's so much that is nowhere near anyone, and we could easily do the cheaper and easier thing, but we try our best not to. We're not perfect, obviously.
I guess, and then just leading on from that, that's one of the big challenges we see a lot of our clients facing, is they want to do the right thing, and then when they start doing the right thing, they're held to account for doing the right thing, and the pressure comes on, and the minute you have to make those decisions in terms of, you know, you've got to make a profit, you've got to make a margin, a business that doesn't is out of business in, you know, in no time at all. How do you make sure you're on top of that the whole time, not just from a sort of sustainable decision? You obviously made the right decisions for the right reasons, but then staying on top of it, constantly making sure that the business you founded, which is now quite the beast, has, you know, the same moral direction that you set out with.
Yeah, it pretty quickly gets way beyond the point where you can kind of see everything and make all the decisions. So it comes down to the culture inside the business, and then just having ways that you can catch stuff that's going wrong and quickly alter things when people maybe make the wrong decisions, which does happen, right? But you know, because you have to try and show people the purpose. So you know, for us, like, you know, we're quite a big, you know, a bit of a bigger business now. So the main thing for us is just getting everyone together every quarter, and all the different leaders of the business talking about their part of the business, be that grocery, be it online, be it high street sustainability, like where we're growing, and trying to set a strategy across the whole business so that other people can then go and follow that. And you know, 9 times out of 10, if you can be really clear with the team about this is where we're going and this is why we're doing it, and these are the pillars of the brand, and we have to stay true to this for these reasons, 9 times out of 10, people will make the right, if not a better decision than you would have made. And then, you know, hopefully there's enough people around who do see the different parts of the business and can help us kind of course correct when we do make mistakes.
I think I think it's really interesting in how you've worded that and articulated it, in as much as we spend quite a lot of time talking to businesses about if you get everybody in their own role thinking about sustainability as part of the decision-making process, so operational, financial, and actually what is the impact of this decision going to be around sustainability, suddenly it's much more natural process that you're not constantly retrofitting it back in and finding sustainability is this other job that sits on the side of what you're doing.
Yeah, it has to be in everything.
I think, you know, that's clearly what's coming through. And I would assume that actually because you are a sustainable coffee brand, and that's how you're viewed, is that's probably helped the bottom line at some point as well in terms of retaining staff, attracting people, but also potentially when you're standing there deciding which coffee you want, there must be some recognition of people going, actually, I feel that aligns with my values, so therefore I'm going to go for it. It's always really hard to talk about with ROI on sustainability, but there's got to be some commercial benefit there as well.
Yeah, look, I think ultimately customers are really clever. Like, I think underestimate the customer at your peril, right? Like, customers are clever, they have choice, they notice stuff, they look at stuff, they listen to stuff, and, you know, ultimately they need to trust you and they need to trust the brand. And so, you know, because they're picking up something and putting it inside their body that you made, like, they need to trust you on so many levels. And, you know, you have to build that over the long time. And that's why I always think that, like, we could never have, you know, had any success in online or in grocery or these other channels without having kind of done 10 years of proving ourselves in real life on the high street, I think has been really important. And then, yeah, you know, you want to build that kind of long-term love for the brand. I think, you know, one of the things that, you know, makes me really happy is when people tell me that they love the brand. They don't say they like the brand, they say, I love the brand. It's like, well, you know, how did that happen? I think it happened because of all of the staff in the stores. It happened because of years of social media and partnerships, and like, it was compounded with, you know, in 100 different ways, and doing the right thing and being a B Corp and being sustainability focused is a really important part of, I think, how we've made some people like the brand a little bit.
I think on that brand issue, you know, you've gone from having a coffee shop in Shoreditch to now, we can see on the seats here, canned coffee. You've got the compostable coffee pods. You're in all major, or the majority of major supermarkets. You've got your partnership with Green Day now, etc. You know, two core questions. You know, how did you get from that coffee shop? And how did you get these people to want to collaborate with you? And what's next?
Yeah, so yeah, the two big ones this year have been, you know, completely different to one another. Green Day and British Airways.
Yeah.
Doesn't get more different than that. So
and Hello Kitty, I think.
Oh, and Hello Kitty.
Hello Kitty. Green Day and BA is not the natural threesome. I don't know if that's the
right. Yeah, no, it's definitely not. Yeah, you don't want to be in the middle of that.
Hello Kitty
not
and
twice.
Is what I want to say.
Yeah. And yeah, look, different stories behind all of those. Green Day is really interesting. They were over for 20 years of American Idiot. They were doing a big show at Wembley, and they happened to be recording near Soho Grind. They all love coffee, and they're actually starting their own coffee brand. And they started going to the local coffee shops in Soho, you know, getting out of the studio. They loved Soho Grind. Then they bought a pod machine out of Soho Grind, took it back to the studio, and then they emailed us saying, hey, do you want to do something together? And that was that. So yeah, it's been amazing. And, you know, obviously we spent a lot of time chasing partnerships. You know, Soho House will be another amazing one that we've been working with Soho House globally since 2020. And, you know, I was always been a huge fan and a member of that business. And, you know, I think now, you know, it's amazing that Green Day came to us, and then we got chatting to British Airways as well. And they've been incredible at, you know, they're really ambitiously trying to, you know, rapidly change and modernize and improve the customer experience on flight as well. So they're another amazing partner where you can do stuff at scale, reach loads of people, and improve, you know, everyone's day a tiny little bit by giving them a cup of coffee on a plane, which is maybe a lot better than it used to be and better than they expected. So we love partnerships like that because, you know, it's amazing for the business, it's amazing for the brand, and it just helps you reach so many new people as well, because it brings their audience to you, and they all serve a different purpose, right? Like, mm-hmm. Hello Kitty is completely different to, and Green Day, these are moments, whereas British Airways and Soho House are like multi-year partnerships that become like a core part of what you do. But, you know, partnerships for us has been absolutely amazing.
We were talking just beforehand around sort of customers and what they want and what they say they want.
Yes.
And their buying habits.
Yeah.
And how they are not always entirely the same thing.
Aligned.
That sometimes they will very much say, I want this, but actually their purchasing power sits somewhere else. Can you talk a little bit more around that? Because I think it's a really interesting point, you know, within business as much as within sustainability.
Yeah.
About, you know, you said, you know, customers are very intelligent and but they're obviously, what the data is telling you and what you're doing with it.
Yeah, it is, you know, when you survey, I guess it's like when you survey Americans' intent to vote and then what they do at the ballot box, right? Like, oh, everyone's intent to vote.
Yeah,
the Brits, exactly. Yeah, so, you know, when you survey people, they say that obviously these are the things they value in this order and they put sustainability really, really high up that list. But when you look at the attributes when they actually buy, sustainability tends to be lower down that list than things like quality, price, and convenience. And look, you know, the last few years have been, you know, cost of living crisis, really expensive for everyone. And, you know, I think if you want to be a niche sustainable brand, that's fine. And you'll have your audience of people who are very, very focused on that. But if you want to be a mass premium brand, which we do, then you have to be, you have to have really high product quality and be priced correctly. You know, maybe a small premium to other things, but not a huge premium. And you have to have the right distribution and you have to have all the sustainability stuff. And you have to have a recognizable brand that people trust to pick up off the shelf. You know, the best example, I think, probably is, you know, the electric car movement. And if you look at electric cars pre-Tesla, they're kind of like these weird hobby things with two seats that were really slow and went 10 miles. And actually, you know, what Tesla did so successfully was to make a product which was not only electric and sustainable, but also, you know, arguably better in every other way. And I think you have to figure out how you can combine all of those things. And then I think the customer will choose the right thing, the sustainable packaging, etc. But you can't make it too much of a leap. Like, you can't ask the customer to compromise on all of this other stuff in order to be sustainable. That's certainly, like, that's our learning so far. And actually, as we've become bigger as a business, it's sometimes, it's harder to do certain things, but it also becomes easier to do other things because you have scale and you can invest in the manufacturing and you can invest in better packaging. And, you know, we've sold 100 million coffee pods so far, I think. And like that kind of volume allows you to go talk to the people who are making the actual body of the pod in the factory or the lid of the pod or whatever and say, hey, could we do this? Could we do that? And you can advance the whole thing and move it forward because of the scale. So I kind of slightly, everyone always assumes it's going to get worse as you get bigger. And I just hate that approach. Like, I think it's all going to get better as you get bigger because the scale just gives you revenue and you can employ smart people and you can figure stuff out in a way that you just can't when you're small.
I think linked to a lot of the stuff you were saying there about the things you can do, the changes you can make, the opportunities you have now. Going back to the sort of first question on the entrepreneur's journey, you know, Grind's a big company now. You could sell it, you could live very well for the rest of your life. Why do you keep going? What is it in you and what's your sort of words to entrepreneurs that wants you to go and make the coffee pot better, make the coffee a bit better, make that experience? I love that phrase you said about BA customers, just having that slightly better cup of coffee and recognizing it. Why do you keep going?
Look, it's a really good question. It's quite a deep question, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It's a bit like meaning of life stuff, isn't it?
No, but every entrepreneur, I think, who goes from startup to scale up, goes through that phase where they go, I could stop now and probably retire. Yeah. But I'm not going to.
Where was the fun in that be, right?
Absolutely.
I don't know. It doesn't really... Listen, at some point, clearly, I would like to like lift the pedal off very slightly and, you know, do some other things at some point. But, you know, it's been a massive privilege to build the business so far. There's been some really bad times, like really bad times, you know, walking around telling several hundred people, don't worry, we're going to be back in a few weeks when we close for the COVID. You know, I'll never forget that week. And then sitting there going, what are we going to do with all these people? Like before the furlough scheme was announced and all of that stuff, you know, some really, really difficult times. But, you know, overall, it's been an amazing journey and it's kind of, it becomes, you know, just part of you, really. Like, I can't imagine separate, you can't You know, someday we will, but you know, it feels so innate, the whole thing. And, you know, it just feels like there's so much more that we can do. And it would be a real shame to kind of to stop now and walk away when it feels like we're only just beginning in a lot of ways.
But a lot of your language is about making a difference. It's about better coffee. It was about making the right decision about the aspiration valve and all this type of stuff. And there's loads of much bigger brands, you know, the ones that you would consider your competitors, who don't think about that difference, who just think about scale. What is it that makes you want to make a difference at the same time as making a lot of money?
Yeah, look, I think we're very open about, you know, we've got 3,000 shareholders who have put money in. You know, some of them it was only a tenner, but, you know, through Crowdcube. And we've got now an ultra high net worth investor who's pumped tens of millions into the business, you know, and we need to provide those shareholders with a return. And at some point, you know, we'd like to sell the business and, you know, obviously, as all entrepreneurs do. But I think we can do that. I don't think that has to be in conflict with doing the right thing. Actually, I think it can help. Like, I think these things are, the natural assumption is that they're somehow in conflict with one another. And I don't think they are. Actually, I think it's helping us. Like, I think a lot of people now, if they say, what do you do? I've got a coffee company called Grinder. Oh, the compostable coffee pod guys. Like, that's kind of how people know of us now. And I don't think we would have had that level of brand recognition had we not differentiated in terms of sustainability. So I don't really see like sustainability or profit. It's just, it's brand and sustainability and growth and profit all together, hopefully in one direction. And sure, sometimes those things butt heads, but you always just then have to make the long-term decision because, you know, otherwise you'll get found out by either by the customers or by the team, or, you know, it just doesn't feel like the right thing to do. So I really think they can work together, those things.
I think some of your communication around that has been quite, what's the word right to use?
Direct.
Cheeky? I might go cheeky.
Yeah.
Have you enjoyed that side of it? I don't know if anyone's seen any of the adverts. I think some of you've sort of pulled up some of your competitors on some of their claims. Yeah. You have opened stores that look very similar. I believe at one point there was a gentleman that looked a little bit like George Clooney.
Yeah, he came and opened one of your stores. That used to be, we actually took over that store and turned it from that store into one of our stores in St Pancras Station. So we thought
that?
we thought we'd get a George lookalike to come and open it. Yeah. Yeah, look, I think you've got to have some fun, first of all. And you've got to try and cut through the noise. And you know, London is in particular, it's very noisy, right? You get on the tube, there's ads everywhere, there's stuff. So you've got to try and get people's attention. And I mean, we genuinely have a lot of fun with those ads. You know, you can imagine what it's like in the head office with the 30 ideas that, and eventually three of them become tube posters, right? Like it is a lot of fun. And I think people need to realize that, like, there's just some humans behind this brand who are having fun and writing things on tube ads that they think other people might laugh at. And you know, at the end of the day, it's coffee, right? Like, let's not take it too seriously. But let's just have a go at doing the right thing and it being fun at the same time.
I think just to comment on that, we talk a lot in the office, but I think that humanizing a brand is the big difference. It's the thing that makes you go from being a sort of run-of-the-mill corporate thing that you can put off the shelf and you know will work, but it has nothing behind it, to something that's relatable, something that you've seen a human being behind it and a human's humor, human's, you know, decisions, somebody who's reflected in that brand.
So I think people notice that, right?
We are going to ask in a few minutes the audience if they've got any questions, but before they do, just a final question from us on what do you think the future, what advice would you offer anyone that's thinking of moving into sort of startups and scale-ups and looking at investment and taking those steps that you have, you know, very lovely, beautifully described about growing a business. Is there anything you'd say to anyone starting out now, what they should be considering and looking at and, you know, lessons you've learned?
Buckle up.
Look,
I think it's not for the faint-hearted for sure. And I think you've really got to want to do it. So I think anyone trying to force themselves to do it, it's not the right thing. It's not the right time. Like it's got to be really clear that this is the thing. Because if you don't, like, I think if I look back and I think, like, how has this happened? Like, it's been so much luck. It's been so much right place at the right time. It's been so much of other people's hard work and amazing team members or investors who have backed us, or, you know, like so much unrelated to me. I think the one thing probably that I've done is just willed it to exist and keep going. And I think that's like, that is ultimately the job of the founder. It's like, I'm going to take it from here to here to here somehow, solve the puzzle, figure it out, and just not be prepared to kind of lie down. I think that's probably the most important thing for a founder is like resilience, because it is like, you know, it's hard. Like stuff happens every day and you're like,
Really?
Yeah. Like, such random stuff. Like, such random stuff goes wrong. And the things that people come and tell me in the office or on Slack or on email or whatever, I'm just like, really? Like, just leave me alone.
I think that phrase you used there is one that we both relate to the most, which is, really?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, okay, wow. All right, yeah, yeah. Yeah. So, you know, you have to, like, just get into understanding that I've kind of made peace with the fact that it's just going to be like that forever. And I almost like have to embrace it, because for a long time it was like, we just get through the next few months and it's going to quieten down. And that's just not the reality. Like, it's going to be like this forever. Actually, it's really fun. It's not stressful. It's just being busy and working hard. And we've made all of the decisions to do all of these things. Like, I've made a lot of the decisions to let's go into grocery, let's go into B2B, let's go into offices, let's do online, let's do this. Like, and we could have not done any of that stuff. Like, I've made that decision, those decisions, time and time again. So you kind of don't complain about it. Just keep going and become resilient and try and enjoy it as well, right? Like, and I'm saying this to myself as much as anyone else. Yeah. Try and enjoy it. Yeah.
Okay.
I think we've got any questions from the audience?
I'm a big fan of the pink. Like, in the morning, you get the pods and you put it into the machine. Was there any actual thought behind the colour, or is it just branding and marketing? Or was there any story?
It's a good question. I probably need to come up with a really good answer to this that's not true. But the true answer is, so we had four stores or something, and we decided to do our first thing called crowdfunding, which was a word that no one had heard back then, but it was like this new thing where you could get customers to invest, long before that was kind of this really normal thing to do. And the advertising company, JC Dassault, had agreed to like sponsor four like marquee brands. So this meant if we did this raise, we also got massive posters up in tube stations and stuff like that. We're like, okay, this sounds good, let's do that. And at that time, we were Shoreditch Grind, Soho Grind, London Bridge Grind, and somewhere, Covent Garden Grind, I guess. So like all individual brands. And it was like, okay, well, we can't put four logos up. So I guess we're going to have to become Grind. And actually, that's a lot easier because we've got four cups and four loyalty cards and four menus and four this. It's like, okay, yeah. Like, amazing how long it takes you to figure stuff like this out when you're starting out. It was like, okay, we need a color now. And I mean, we really struggled to come up with like, what is the color? Like, we had red in the first store, we had black, none of it was right. We're like, okay, let's look at some of our favorite images that we'd had done. So at the time, you know, you start to build up this library of your favorite images. And one of them had one of our red neon signs reflecting off of a marble table into a red cup, which are all kind of our signature things, like a red neon, a red cup, a marble table. And it had like caused this like pink glow. And we were literally sat there with like the Photoshop like pipette thing. I think it's called a pipette, right? Like where you grab a bit of colour in Photoshop and we're like, oh, that looks good. We're like, yeah, that looks good. And that was it. And I think around the same time it got kind of coined millennial pink. And, you know, the rest is history. And I think probably that pipette moment was quite important. I think we really wanted something that just didn't look like all the other kind of hipster brown Brooklyn exposed light fitting kind of aesthetic that had just been done to death. So we wanted something that looked a little bit less like that. So pink it is.
One of the things that I really admire about the business is the way that you guys not just jump on trends, but like adapt them and drive them. And Bottomless Brunch has got to be the best at Grind cafes. I'm really interested in how in the process of decision-making in the business, you actually balance the innovation in coming up with these great tube ads, the colors, the jumping on trends, the bottomless brunches, with the sustainability ethos of the company. What's the, like, how do you choose whether to say yes or no to an idea based on the sustainability impact?
Yeah, I mean, some of the trends and stuff we do on TikTok now, I don't even understand. But luckily, all of the social media team are all 10 years, 15 years younger than me now, and they all say it's fine. Don't worry about it, David.
Imagine how I feel.
Yeah, yeah. But look, I think all of this stuff, you've got to resonate with the audience, right? And there's only so many times you can tell them that your pods are compostable. Like, I think people get that and they like that, but you have to find other ways to communicate with people and get their attention. And that has to be one of the brand pillars, not the brand. So like the other things have to be about being different and quirky and fun and interesting and engaging. And you know, and I think probably back to the question earlier, like, you know, we're just, if someone proposes some new product development that's just, I can't even remember an example of where someone proposed an MPD that was like environmentally horrific in some way, because I just don't think that's really in the culture of the business that they would do that. So it's not like every week we say no to 10 ideas because we don't think they're good enough from a sustainability perspective. I think it just doesn't really even get that far. It's normally, okay, we've got an idea to do this MPD thing. Obviously, we're not going to do it like this, and we're going to do it like this because that fits the brand language, that fits what our customers expect of us, what everyone else expects. So it's relatively natural. And then, you know, we're a B Corp as well. So having that as, you know, we're kind of surrounded by this regulation in terms of, we're surrounded by the B Corp regulation. In our roastery, we're surrounded by our BRC accreditation, which is the standards that you have to uphold in a food manufacturing facility, which are like, you know, put a beard net on, put a hat on, take this off, clean everything 100 times a day, like really high standards. And so when you're operating in the framework of B Corp, we also have a charity, which you guys very kindly help us set up and administer. So we have our own charity. So we remove ocean bound plastic for every pod, can or bag that we sell. So I think, you know, 60,000 tons of ocean bound plastic this year. So when you start to create these things that sit around you, it kind of naturally course corrects and keeps you on the right track, because if you don't do the right thing, you will very obviously be breaching one of these different things that you've kind of told everyone you would do and you're really committed to do. I feel like that was a slightly random rambling answer, but maybe we got somewhere near an answer there.
Actually, you kind of answered my question in your rambling answer, but first of all, amazing.
Perfect.
What a great story. From the coffee shop to huge success. But I do have another question, and it's about your coffee supply chain. And I'm just wondering, and obviously your B Corp and all the rest of it, but I'm just wondering, have you ever been out to where your coffee comes from, and, you know, how involved are you in that whole process?
We love the word supply chain at the moment. Everything is about supply chains these days, especially now we're working with grocers, working with much bigger companies. You know, supply chain goes from something you don't hear that much about to something you hear 20 times every day. We're super, super involved in that. So I actually, unfortunately, haven't been to Origin yet, but all of my team have been dozens of times. And I've had my trip booked multiple times and moved it. But I think I'm going to Costa Rica in January, finally. But, you know, so when we first started roasting our own coffee, we were doing that in a room twice the size of this stage in Shoreditch, attached to our head office. And I employed a guy called Howie to come and do it. And he literally helped us in-source it when we had four cafes. And he would roast it, pack it, and then hire a zip van and drive it around to our sites. And he's still our head of coffee and sourcing now. He's an amazing guy. And I think, there he is, look, right on cue. I think there's an image on here of the roastery now, and it's obviously scaled up a little bit since then. But, you know, we are super involved in that. We've visited 98-99% of the farms in terms of volume. We work directly with collectives in places like Brazil that we've helped expand from one farm to half a valley. And, you know, that's super important. And again, like, it's a classic example of how scale is good, because firstly, like, I can afford to send the team there, and five people and our QC person and our B Corp person, I can afford to send them there a few times a year. Couldn't do that at the start. And we buy enough coffee now, we buy a lot of coffee, so we can go and work directly with these guys and say, hey, like, how about we do it like this, and let's agree a price and let's score it. And we can contract directly with them without lots of people in the middle who are all taking a cut, which means we're getting actually probably a better price than we would have historically, and the farmer is also getting a price than they would have historically because there's nothing in the middle, and we can agree multi-year deals with them, and that means they know they can expand with confidence and they can take on that other farm into the collective or do this other thing or buy this other bit of equipment, and we get the benefit and they get the benefit. So it's massively important, and you know, we're keen to take any opportunity we can to kind of get more coffee into the grind system, because we know that the more coffee that's going through our system, that good is happening at all the different parts of the supply chain, right back to origin. I'll let you know how Costa Rica is.
I can confirm that, you know, having had, so I'm very luckily still involved in the Coffee Foundation, and I know that all of our conversations, and you know, you are on first name terms with all of those coffee growers, you know, how he is, yeah. and those conversations are really in depth, but he knows who they are and what they absolutely. Do, and we've been really lucky to look into that with you guys as well. So it's not just a, we want to be working with farmers, but you've really looked into the individual parts of that, how it's growing, what's being used, where, you know, what water is. So, I think there's been a really close relationship that we found to be really part of your story and not an addition to it. And I think that's been really cool.
And I think it takes a certain amount of bravery, you know, the life cycle analysis we did for you of everything, to actually want to lift, you know, the curtain on everything, look at every point of production. And literally a life cycle analysis goes down to what's the manure being put on the plants that grow the coffee beans that then end up in the pod. And to lift that curtain, it takes a certain amount of bravery.
I love the brand. I think it's a really clean design. I love the look. And I love how you're partnering with a variety of companies from completely different industries. Kind of two-part question is, one, how important is who you're getting to invest in you, and kind of what are the key aspects you look at when you're going into a partnership deal or a branding deal or receiving just investment from banks or whoever that might be? What are the key things you look for?
Yeah, so look, in terms of partners, brand partners, you know, can they help us achieve our mission of getting more people drinking better coffee? Do we think they're a brand that we're aligned with and that kind of makes sense to us and makes sense to our customers? And like, there's not like a really complex process. Like Stacey, our brand director, is amazing, and you know, she'll filter everything or come up with ideas about who we want to approach. And then the ones that are on the fence, we kind of go in the office, you know, oh, these guys have emailed, what do you think? And like, we'll have a chat about it for 5 minutes and just decide. There's not like a matrix where it's not particularly scientific. It's like, just does this feel like the right thing for us to do? And then look, in terms of investors, you know, I'm sure we could do an hour on investment alone, and it's really complicated. And obviously your perfect investor is, you know, both easygoing and hands off and adds value and shares your vision and is aligned with you in every possible way. And I think that in reality, we have been really lucky to find investors that probably tick like 9 out of 10 of those boxes, but not maybe not 10 out of 10 all the time. I think, you know, when you're scaling a business, the power ebbs and flows between you and your investors. You know, sometimes things are going great guns and you feel like you could go and raise as much money as you want from anyone you wanted and the power is all yours. And then suddenly we're a bit behind plan and things are not going so well, and actually we need a top up, and you know, the power goes back to the investors. So really it's just about having long-term relationships with your investors, being honest, being upfront, and being transparent about where you are on the journey, and just filling them with confidence that even when things don't go exactly to plan, because they never do, that you know, it's the right thing to keep going and not change the mission and not change course too much.
Thank you so much. That was a really great conversation, really good questions as well. Maybe I'm asking one to wrap everything up. You talk about resilience as an entrepreneur, and it really resonates with all of us who are entrepreneurs here. How did you build a brand like Grind to be resilient? What are the elements of Grind that you built it to be such a resilient brand? And did transparency play a role in that?
Yeah, look, so, you know, if we talk about how has the brand been resilient, well, the ultimate example of that is COVID, right? So, you know, March 2020, we've got a dozen stores or maybe a couple more, And 99% of our revenue was coming through those high street stores, tiny bits elsewhere. And then that shuts down. Luckily, we'd been building kind of on the side as a bit of a side project, the compostable pods. We built a Shopify store. We'd started to build a roastery. We'd put aside some budget for Facebook ads. And we'd started tinkering with that in January, February. And then, you know, the world changed overnight, as we all know. And so we threw everything at this online thing, which just meant emailing our customers every couple of days going, we're closed, but you can still have ground coffee at home. Please buy some. And, you know, Shopify on my phone goes from like, okay, wow. Like, this is insane. Like, you know, the response from customers in those first few days was amazing. And that period of my life was the most insane time, like closing down that business, seeing the other part of the business explode, then going, oh my God, we've got 3,000 orders to fulfill now. And we've got like three people. How does that work? Like, oh, and we've got no stuff and the ports are closed and we've got no boxes and we've got no tins and we've got no coffee. So, okay, cool. Go figure that out. So that was fun. Everyone talks about this like chilled lockdown where everyone was in the garden and stuff. I missed all of that. But, you know, that was, and I think the resilience of the brand there was that, you know, over the 7 or 8 years leading up to that, people liked the brand. And because they'd had a good experience in our stores, because the team that served them had been great, because they enjoyed the product, the design, the whatever else, you know, because we'd thought it was a good idea to capture people's emails when they used the Wi-Fi or used the loyalty scheme, you know, we were able to build that. So I guess the answer to the question is, if you can get customers to love the brand and you can be in direct contact with customers, that's how you build resilience. Because when you're intermediated through grocery or through wherever else, like, you don't quite have as direct a relationship as you do with the customers in your stores or the customers that go to your website and buy you. So if you can have, you know, we've got a universe now of, I don't know, a million people or something who we're in touch with. And I guess that's probably, I've never even thought about it until you asked this question. So good question. But I guess that's how you build resilience, right? Being in direct contact with your customers and being diversified across lots of different channels so that no one thing can hopefully take you down. If one disaster does happen over here, nothing worse for a high street central London business in hospitality than a global pandemic. Well, okay, we can shift into this other thing and keep going. So knowing your customer would be the short answer.
And the transparency helped as well, being really clear and transparent with them.
Yeah, I think so. I think that was all just part of the DNA of the brand and our tone of voice and who we were about being honest. And we never pretended to be perfect and we never pretended to have all the ideas. We just were kind of having a go. And I think people don't expect you to be perfect. They just expect you to try and kind of do what you say you're going to do and then say we messed up if you mess up. No better example than the famous GB News incident.
Yeah.
Which you guys helped us through as well. We won't go into that. No, we
can go into what a note to end on. Though, you know, you can go Google it if you like.
That's all we've got time for. And thank you so much to David for joining us. If you'd like to join the conversation and you're listening, please leave comments or any questions you have in the email section below or email us at info@future-plus.co.uk. And please remember to hit the subscribe button for future episodes. And if you'd like to find out more about Future Plus or Grind, please see the links in the description below. Thank you, David.
Thank you.